A podcast of the cinema.
Hello, Alonzo Durrell there.
Hello, Dave White.
You're the co-host.
And you're the co-host.
It's true. We're both film critics.
We are.
I mean, kind of. We don't have jobs, but like...
we're as much a film critic as most people who are like, call themselves.
We're like teachers who are on summer vacation without pay.
Is this what at large means?
Yes.
Are we at large?
Quite. That is what that means.
Yeah.
So this is a podcast about films.
Yes.
We're the film critics.
And nowadays, who even knows what films are? We're talking about stuff that's on streaming services. We're talking about stuff that was supposed to open in theaters and didn't. We're talking about something on a cable network. Who cares? Nothing means anything anymore. So yeah, we're just going to cover things, and they're all things you can... presumably we watching, if you're in the United States, beyond that, I don't know. I guess Netflix stuff is generally international.
Not always.
Unless it's some like weird like TV series that airs on a network here, but everywhere else is a Netflix show like Riverdale.
Sure. I have no idea.
No.
I don't know how things work. All I know is how things work in this house.
Not even that.
Because I haven't let... listen to you. I haven't left this house in 8 weeks, so I'm...
You know how long we've been here?
As of the day after tomorrow, 8 weeks.
We have been here so long that, remember early on, the last time I tried doing laundry in our laundry room before we decided that it was a cesspit and we weren't setting foot in it again?
Yes.
And I tripped going down the steps with my flip-flops and scraped up my foot?
I remember that day. It was a day of horror.
My foot is completely healed.
Yeah.
That's how long we've been here.
I was very scared that day because I thought, oh no, what if we have to take you to the hospital?
It wasn't that bad.
And then you like catch something in the hospital.
I bounced right back up.
I nursed you. I was the doctor and the nurse that day.
You poured alcohol on my foot and enjoyed how uncomfortable that made me.
I won't say it was a lot of enjoyment. But I kind of like it when you make the flinch.
Love shouldn't hurt.
Listen, sometimes love does.
Sometimes it stings.
Sometimes though. Love stings when someone's tending to your literal wound.
True.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
I'm going to have to make you pause this in about 30 minutes when my alarm goes off.
Yeah, I figured. You had me put potatoes in the oven.
Potatoes are coming out.
I assume that meant, oh, well, here comes a show interruption.
It's going to be a show interruption.
Okay, fine.
Well, we're recording this show Monday afternoon.
We are.
4:30-ish p.m. It's now 5.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
again, nothing means anything.
Anyway, I would like to get right into the film talks.
Okay.
Because we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 films to talk about. No. 4. Well, we did also watch The Wicker Man. Why did you watch The Wicker Man?
I watched The Wicker Man for breakfast all day.
Oh, okay. All right. Did y'all talk about that already?
Yeah, once a month, our Patreon members over there choose a classic film for us that at least one of us has never seen. And I think at least two of us had never seen the original The Wicker Man. And then it turned out the timing was perfect. We were late. Like, that was our April screening, and we didn't talk about it until May 1st.
But that's a movie.
But it's a movie about May Day. So it all worked out.
It's the horniest May Day.
Boy, howdy.
Ever. What a great movie that is.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
It's such a in your face, kind of upside down cross of a film.
Do people go to Burning Man thinking it's going to be like this? And there's going to be like all these beautiful naked people romping around,
humping on the ground,
singing folk songs about barley,
worshiping the maypole.
Yeah.
Class, what's the maypole? A penis.
A phallic symbol. Well done, children. So we have four movies.
We have four movies. Anyway, it's still so much to move through.
Indeed.
So little to see and so much time to see it.
Strike that. Reverse it. Not coincidentally, our club meeting this month for Patreon members of I always get my levels confused.
12.
No, I know, but it's Veruca and higher.
Our club levels are actually named
for
after
the movie that we're watching.
In this film,
We are bringing it back around. Veruca and
this
higher
time,
can join us for Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. On
now,
Netflix.
Those of you who are at the $12 Patreon level, who were promised a club meeting of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory in March.
Yeah, it was a couple months ago.
And then we realized at the last minute that the film had been taken off of Netflix.
Yes.
So instead we wound up watching Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, which is...
not the same thing.
But you know what? It was good and long.
It was.
And that is something...
And very
distracting. People were happy to have at that moment. But now Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory is back on Netflix. So we're going to give it another go.
Yeah. It might be the movie I have seen the most times of any
in your life?
In my life.
Yeah, not me.
Yeah.
I've seen it, you know, several times.
Yeah.
But not like the Poseidon Adventure, not like What's Up, Doc.
Right.
Not like Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. Like, those three are kind of like, I'll just sit down and watch them.
Yeah.
It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah, but still.
Desk set.
Sure, but I think I may have seen Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory more times than any other movie in my life. You and I went to see it.
We did.
For the 25th anniversary reissue in 96. Yeah.
1996, 25th anniversary theatrical reissue. We went to see it.
Mm.
Which
they threw into theaters the same weekend as like some big Disney thing. I'm like, oh, well, no one's going to this.
Yeah. There was a big other Disney movie released that same
whatever
weekend,
the 96 one was, Pocahontas?
I don't know.
Something?
But we were alone in that Willy Wonka screening.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Which I thought,
fine by me.
Yeah, who are all you not people not here? What's your problem? All right. The new Netflix film, the half of it.
Yes.
We watched. It's from director Alice Wu.
Mm-hmm.
She is the director of the 2004 comedy drama.
I think it's a rom-com with some dramatic elements.
Saving Face.
Yes.
Now, I had never seen Saving Face, so we...
Weirdly, neither had I.
We prepped for the half of it by watching Saving Face, which is a lovely little, you know... I want to call it a 90s indie movie, because even though it's from 2004, it's a 90s indie movie.
Okay, well, all right. There was the new queer cinema of the early 90s, which was a lot more experimental and in-your-face, Living End, Poison, you know, that kind of stuff. And then you get like Go Fish, which is super low budget, but also very accessible and charming. Then you get the wave of like, oh, we can make some money on this. And so then you get some like medium budget movies like Jeffrey and All Over the Guy and Billy's Hollywood Screen Kiss.
Right.
And, you know, the movies that are sort of aimed at being, like, crossover titles.
Yeah.
And Saving Face feels like it would have been part of that wave. It just came about 10 years later.
Yeah.
But it is very much, it is unabashedly a lesbian romantic
for sure
film.
Yeah.
But at the same time is very much a Chinese-American film.
Yes.
You know, with an entire, like, set of characters who are Chinese immigrants themselves.
Right.
You know,
about half the film is English, the other half is Mandarin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, but it is designed to be as universal as possible.
Yeah.
You know, and none of that is a bad thing. I'm just saying, but it does feel like that kind of next wave of post new queer cinema movies.
It is the kind of movie that I thought I knew how it would end, and I was surprised.
Yeah.
Which, in spite of the fact that it has the aesthetic, the budget, the occasional clunkiness, you know, how many takes do we get? One? Okay, that's what we're going to go with. That kind of film. In spite of all those other things, it surprised me with its commitment to people behaving more or less like people really behave.
Yes, I think that is a fair cop for that one. You know, but it's really well cast. You've got Joan Chen, you've got Michelle Krusiek, who is apparently now on Netflix's Hollywood, which we have to check out for better or worse.
I hear for worse.
But we'll make up our own minds. And Lin Chen. So, like, you know, really strong cast. What I thought was fascinating about after watching it, I mean, I thought Saving Grace was great. And then I'm like, and then why did Alice Wu not make another movie for, you know, what, 16 years? Sorry. I'm off on my math. 16 years.
I'm the one that needs a calculator to add single digits.
Sorry.
What's your problem?
16 years. And it turns out it wasn't because, like, there was this grand Hollywood conspiracy to shut out, you know, a queer Asian-American female director, even though that scans.
Right.
Turns out she just didn't feel like it particularly. Like, her mom got sick and she went and took care of her. She had made some early, like, Microsoft investments that she could live on for a while.
Oh.
And just did not feel driven to, like, make a follow-up movie until she did. And then she did, and she sold it to Netflix, and now we have the half of it.
Cool. The half of it is about a teenage girl in the Pacific Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
She, her name is
Ellie Chu.
Ellie Chu, not to be confused with Alice Wu, the name of the film here. Although totally to be confused with her, because the character of Ellie and the main character in Saving Face kind of have a lot in common.
Yeah.
They also have parent types in common as well. In Saving Face, the young doctor, main character whose name I cannot remember, her mom...
Lin Chen plays the doctor.
Okay. Her mom, played by Joan Chen,
of
Twin Peaks, is obsessed with watching soap operas on TV and is sort of like...
And always pointing out, oh, this is the best
part. Always pointing out this is the best part. And sort of inviting other people in the world around her to come watch them with her.
Yes. To the point where, like, her black American neighbor who speaks not one word of Mandarin is glued to the set with her and, like, weeping over these soaps.
Yeah, that character, he exists just to be, like, the friend next door who is part, like, comic relief, you know. But anyway, in the half of it, Ellie, the teenage character, has a single father, a widowed father, who is obsessed with watching old movies and constantly sort of having her join him and always saying, wait, oh, here's the best part. So it's funny that we watched them sort of back to back.
Yeah.
So that we did in fact pick up.
You pointed out that vending
narrative similarities
play a key role in certain scenes too.
There's a very vending machine narrative hook in both of these films, but the so what happens is there is a girl in Ellie's class that she is infatuated with, and she also knows this sort of, on the surface, appears to be a big lunkhead.
Yeah.
Jock.
Yes.
Who is also obsessed with...
Aster Flores.
Her name is Aster.
Okay. Aster Flores. I don't know why I love that name.
That's a good name.
But I love the name Aster Flores.
That's a great name. It's a good character name.
Yeah.
He's obsessed with her, too.
His
name is Paul. He can't get the words out.
Yeah.
So, in true Cyrano de Bergerac fashion, he enlists Ellie to write love letters to Aster. he enlists her to do this because she's the smartest girl in school. She does the homework. She writes other people's term papers for her.
She writes for cash.
She's writing the reports
and term papers of like the entire class.
She makes money doing this.
Her English teacher even knows.
Knows it's happening and just sort of like make your money. And
don't make me read what they would actually write.
Yeah, exactly.
She was played by Becky Ann Baker, by the way.
Yes, from Freaks and Geeks.
Yes.
And a triangle ensues.
Yes.
One with consequences that I did not expect, other than, of course, the big reveal, which always winds up being something, you know, a big set piece, a big sort of wacky set piece. In these films where this sort of thing happens, it all, everything always converges in one spot, and everyone is sort of like, bah! You know, freaking out about it. Someone invariably gets slapped in the face, and...
But it's a small town, you know.
It's a small town, so, you know, everybody being in the same place is not out of the question. But then after the big reveal... It goes into places I did not expect it to go because I expect mainstream filmmaking to give me very pat, very easy resolutions that might even defy, you know, logic or the way that people really behave.
And or even the way the characters have been set up until that point.
Very much like Saving Face, these people behave more like people than like pawns in a story that have to be moved around the playing board
to get a predictable way
to get to the happy ending. And that made me really like it a lot. It's got a bit of a Gilmore Girls feel to it in some ways.
Yes. Elaborate.
Just the coziness of the town.
Sure.
And the way that you see people, sort of caring for each other in small ways that you don't always, see coming, or the film doesn't make a huge big deal about.
It's a cozy town, but at the same time, it's a town that Ellie has to get the hell out of.
Oh, unlike Gilmore Girls, it's not the kind of town that is cozy and that you want to stay in.
Yeah, it's not welcoming.
She's extremely lonely.
Yes.
And that is communicated really well, also, just with camera shots.
Yeah.
And
she's the one Asian kid at Squamish High School.
That's another element involved where, you know, the child of an immigrant parent in a small town, and you're the only person of color, you're the only person who is, you know, with a parent that doesn't really speak all that much English. Right. You're the only person like you.
Yeah.
And that is evocative of... of another sort of loneliness narrative, the queer teenager who thinks they are the only one as well.
Sure.
And so all these things are working toward the same objective, but on different levels.
Yeah, this is a movie that I think, you're right, it does set up a very familiar scenario and then casts it off in a lot of different directions and does so by letting the characters grow to the fullest extent of themselves.
Yeah.
And not just, like you said, get sort of shoved into this slot that they have to do so that everything ends in the way it's supposed to
end. You learn stuff about the jock boy that make you like feel hopeful for him and feel, you know, his plight as someone who just stammers and stutters and can't articulate himself. Can't say what he really feels. Yeah. You know.
The three lead,
because he's not bad.
Yeah, well, no, absolutely.
He's not a jerk who's just trying to get this girl.
The three lead performances, I want to mention these actors because they're all so great. Leah Lewis plays Ellie, Alexis Lemire as Astor Flores, and Daniel Deemer as Paul. They're great. They're believable, interesting and eccentric and just all the things that you would want. Drea had a great observation when we talked about this on Who Shot You, which is that so many recent teen movies are so referential to John Hughes in one way or another.
Yes.
That she appreciated the fact that this is a movie where people talk about, like, you know, Wings of Desire and The Remains of the Day.
Yes.
You know, which is another Gilmore Girls kind of thing, which is like...
That's where I was going also with that as well.
Very bright teenagers who are interested in, you know, more challenging levels of culture.
And like Gilmore Girls, this is not a slam, but they all speak like they're the same person. They all talk like they're cut from the same,
But
screenwriter's
I don't think that's true. Well,
imagination.
Paul certainly doesn't.
Yes and no.
I think Paul.
He's not full of pop culture
No,
references,
but
but.
I think that like when I like okay, for example, early on there's a moment where Ellie is trying to explain Sartre's no exit to Paul, and Paul
Yes.
does not understand the idea of like there's a door and the person refusing to leave it when he could.
Right.
And then eventually he does get it, and he explains it in a way that somebody like Paul would explain it.
Yeah.
Not in some sort of like foofy English professor kind of way, but in a way that he would grasp it, that guy in this town who does this stuff and has this family, whatever. So like I thought that to me felt like a distinct character speaking in a distinct way. I grant you, Ellie and Aster speak in the same way, and I think that's part of
Right.
their connection. The
Right.
whole point is they're the only two people in Squamish who do talk that way and think that way,
Yeah.
and that's why they have this connection, even though Ellie thinks that the letters, even though Aster thinks the letters are coming from Paul.
Right.
This is a great movie.
It's very sweet, and it's not, I don't want to hype it too hard.
Okay. It is great for what it wants to be, which is a smart teen
It's
rom-com.
very sweet. It's very, yeah, it's not a stupid teen movie, which is
The norm.
always refreshing. Now, under normal circumstances, if there were big films being released into theaters this weekend, the fact that we missed this next film on its initial release earlier in the year, like I guess January, early February,
What
late
are we talking
January,
about?
and then we danced.
Oh, no, it played at Sundance. I don't think it opened until like February or March. We stopped to look. It opened in New York February 7th and LA February 14th,
Yes.
but there was a lot of other stuff going on
It
and
was
we didn't
here
get
and
to it.
gone in a couple weeks, and then I thought, oh, I missed that one. Maybe when it comes to streaming. Well, here's the thing. That kind of film opens in New York and Los Angeles in February and then relies on theatrical rollout over the next, up to 6 months. Like,
Sure.
if you live in a medium-sized city with an art house, that film might get booked, but it might not get booked until June.
Sure.
Like it already played in the major art house markets before you, but it's finally coming to,
Kansas City.
Santa Fe. Okay, so I know that this movie got its theatrical run stopped cold, and so what happened was is this thing where certain art house theaters are pair are partnering with indie film distributors, art house film distributors, and going halvesies on the profits for streaming.
Or whatever Z is. Maybe not half. I
Yeah.
don't know.
You know what I mean? On a streaming release that, you go to the movie theater that you were gonna, you go to the website of the movie theater that you would be possibly seeing it in your city or any other city really. You just type it into Google, it'll pop up on whoever's got it. You can rent it for streaming and you can watch it. And I would have let this one go if not for that and for the fact that friend Jason Shawhan keeps bothering me about this movie.
He's a booster.
He was like, "Have you seen it? And then we danced. Have you seen it? And then we danced. Have you seen it? And then we danced." I'm like, "Nope, not yet.
He
Nope,
works
not yet.
at
Nope,
the
not yet."
historic Belcourt Cinema
Yeah,
in Nashville. Maybe that's one of the places you can benefit. We
maybe.
watched this at outfest.org. So it benefited Outfest. I think Newfest also on their site
Oh,
has
yeah.
it. So yeah, the way things are going now, it's usually a partnership with a screening venue, whether it's a commercial theater or a nonprofit, cinema space. But in some cases, as this one, they're also partnering with festivals. So, so we kicked a little something to Outfest here in Los Angeles from what we paid to rent, and then we danced.
And I'm glad that he kept on me about it because very much like the half of it, this is a wonderful queer film.
Yeah.
It is set in Georgia,
the
country,
yes,
not the state.
I think if you say Georgia, people tend to know that you don't mean the state.
Say it again that way?
Georgia.
Georgia.
Yeah.
Well,
that's what I don't know how to, used to do. I don't know.
I don't know how to say it that way. Georgia.
Yeah. Really lean into the vowels.
Georgia. Fine. It's from Georgia. Not the United States, Georgia. No,
the former Soviet.
The former Soviet Republic, Georgia. Okay. It is from filmmaker Levin Aiken, who is Georgian himself, but lives in Sweden.
Yes.
And the story involves a young man named Merab, who is a dancer with the National Georgian State, you know, dance ensemble.
Yes.
And he has a female partner named Mary, and they were paired as children at age 10 to be each other's dance partner in this very strict, very rigid, very conservative, traditionalist dance ensemble.
Yeah, it's a kind of folkloric dance that is super prescribed and has very, like, not just strict choreography in terms of not differing from the steps, but in terms of, like, the masculine and feminine presentation there.
Yes. Like, from the get-go in this movie, the cruel instructor... The taskmaster, the instructor is constantly on this kid's, you know, case about you're too soft.
Be like a nail,
that's the quote. You know, this is a masculine dance. You must be rigid and powerful and strong and communicate
strength.
Traditional masculinity.
Right.
But, you know, this kid wants to do a little more dancing with his hands. Sometimes you just gotta let the hands flutter.
Well, I was gonna say, I think it's more about the flutter than the hands, because there's a lot of hands no matter what.
There is.
It's all in what you do with them and where you put them.
Yeah, yeah. But his body, even, like when the instructor says, be a nail, he isn't. He won't be. He can't be.
And you see somebody else do the same steps. You're like, oh, that's what you meant.
Yeah. Well, in walks Irakli.
Yeah.
Who is like a...
Substitute.
A substitute dancer who shows up. And he gets put into the routine. And he is like... He is that nail.
Strong like bull.
When he's doing it, when he's doing the dance, you're like, oh, I see the difference. Like, one of you is more sort of supple and
flowing.
Movie aroundy and Martha Grammy.
You're a building with feet.
Yeah. But you are doing the thing. And obviously the instructor is impressed.
Yeah, that's what he wants.
Well, Merab, who Mary, poor thing, thinks is going to be her first time.
Yeah.
And he says, I'm sorry, I can't do that with you because...
Wait, I want the first time to be special.
It should be special for you. Meanwhile, he's like, no, this is not... We would both be very unhappy in this scenario.
Your first time should be on the moon. So until that can happen, I really can't...
But when Irakli walks in, Merab, his head goes boing
Tex Avery time.
And they grow closer. Much closer.
Very close.
Very close. In a way that causes problems for Merab, not so much Irakli, because we won't spoil it.
Yeah.
But the process of this romance pushes Merab to a place he needs to go.
Yeah.
And it's been 3 hours since we saw this film, and I love it. I mean, it's not the best directed film I've ever seen, although it's not badly
No,
directed.
there's one very impressive sequence
Well,
where,
there's more than one.
well, the one that sticks in my mind is there's a after a after a key sort of dramatic moment has happened, Marab walks through this crowded apartment at a
A wedding
party,
reception,
yeah,
yeah.
and the camera is like, he's walking toward the camera, which is kind of moving backwards, and then the camera then whips around, follows him out the door, and then the camera moves its way back through the party into the window, and then we see him out the window where something else happens.
Right.
And I was like, oh, okay.
I love that sequence. I love the sequence where he dances to a Robin song
That's a really great sequence too.
while mostly not wearing clothes, but wearing a traditional,
Sheep wool hat.
yeah, wearing a traditional hat that is very much a part of the masculine
Right.
presentation of the Georgian National Ensemble. So there's
Subversion.
yeah, everything is being visually, punched at here.
Yeah.
And then there's the finale, which I super won't spoil, but made me feel
No, it is breathlessly
wonderful.
done, yeah.
You know what? I take back what I said earlier that it's not the best directed film. It's quite well directed, and it is directed with an eye that I don't know Levin Aitken's sexual orientation, but
How cruising
he
works?
understands how cruising works, and he understands how the look
Yes.
works. He understands what a queer man sees when he is looking at another man. He understands what it means to be looked at that way. He understands the silence that can still communicate
Yes.
between two people.
Yeah, it's interesting because
Because
this,
it's a silence brought on by oppression.
of course. Yeah, this is a movie that, like, I think it sets you up, at least it set me up to sort of expect certain, I guess in the same way with The Half of It.
Yes.
Like, it is very much a movie set in a, competitive dance company.
Yeah.
So we're sort of expecting those tropes and
Yeah.
that sort of, like at some point, like various characters are competing for the one spot in the
Right.
national ensemble. And
Right.
so you're expecting that kind of storyline. And that doesn't unfold the way that you think it's going
It
to.
does not.
It's also a coming out movie from a part of the world that has virtually no history of queer cinema.
Oh, yeah.
Which, and I've talked about this before at Outfest, like, the American coming out movie has sort of been done to death unless you really bring something special to it. It's like yawn, whatever. But you bring me one from like Bermuda or South Korea or the Caribbean, like parts of the world that don't normally have a lot of gay movies, and this is sort of their first venture in that department, then that's automatically interesting and a breakthrough. And this movie is that, but it's way more interesting and better made than that it's being first isn't the only thing that it's bringing to the table.
Something I'd like to, expand on this. I'd say in the past 5-ish years, I've been seeing, more and more people who are like you and me, film, enthusiastic people, film critics,
Sure.
just sort of, progressive audiences. Talk about a sort of hierarchy of oppression within the queer community.
Right.
And this is a story of two queer white cisgender men.
Yes.
However,
In the former Soviet Republic of Georgia.
I would like to read you the section of the Wikipedia page about this film, about its reception
Oh, yes. Please do.
in Georgia.
Yes.
Ultra-conservative and pro-Russian groups threatened to cancel the screening of the film in Tbilisi and Batumi, Georgia. Head of the get a load of this name, Children Protection Public Movement.
Oh, boy.
They're always out there trying to protect their kids. Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? We're trying to protect our queer kids from you.
Yeah.
How you like that?
Sheesh.
Head of the Children Protection Public Movement, Levon Palavandishvili, pro-Russian businessman Levon Vasadze, head of Russian Yevgeny Primakov Foundation in Georgia, Dmitry Lordkapenzi, sorry, I'm killing these names.
Bleep right over them.
And the leader of the ultra-nationalist movement, Georgian March, Sandro Bragadze, announced they would go to the cinemas and not allow the showing of the film. Quote, which is against Georgian and Christian traditions and values and popularizes the sin of sodomy. The director of the film, Levon Aiken, responded to the threats, saying it is absurd that people who bought tickets need to be brave and risk getting harassed or even assaulted just for going to see a film. I made this film with love and compassion. Hey, there you go. Potatoes are ready.
One moment.
I'm going to go get them out of that oven.
You do that.
All right. And we're back.
Yes.
Look at my potato. It's like dinner from the Turin horse here. They'll cool a little bit.
Yes.
Until the show's over, and then I'll make the other things.
Yes. Which we'll talk about on Linoleum Knife and Fork.
Maybe not. This is not one of those kinds of, hey, here's a recipe that you're just going to run right out and do. I'm just trying to get rid of the vegetables that are about to go, that are about to turn, you know. Yes,
but that's a topic as well.
It is a topic because of these uncertain times.
Especially now.
But, like, anyway, let's get back to talking about the violence that attended the screening of this film.
Yes, let's.
In Georgia. The Georgian Orthodox Church disapproved of the film's premiere, but also stated that, quote, the church distances itself from any violence.
Thanks.
On the 8th of November 2019, the Ministry of Internal Affairs of Georgia mobilized police troops at Amirani Cinema and nearby territory and placed special riot police troops near the territory of Philharmonic Hall. Police officers surrounded the entrance to the building of Amirani Cinema. Later that day, several hundred members of Georgian March attempted to break the police cordon and forcibly enter the building of Amirani Cinema, but they were stopped by the police. The protesters wore masks and used pyrotechnics. Despite the attempts, all screenings of the film took place as planned. The police detained two persons and accused them of violating Article 173, of the Code of Administrative Offenses of Georgia, which is disobedience of lawful order of a police officer, and Article 166, hooliganism.
Ooh.
One of the leaders of the Republican Party of Georgia, Davit Berdzenshvili, was attacked by the protesters. Civil activist Anna Subalani was also heavily injured in a clash with protesters and sent to the hospital. So this is what happens when queer anything
happens and
goes down.
You and I will talk about this more next month when it premieres on HBO, but keep an eye out for a new documentary called Welcome to Chechnya, which also premiered at Sundance this year, which we watched, the new film from David France. And
when
it's
is
about,
that happening?
It's,
June?
It's premiering on HBO in June.
Okay.
And it's basically about how crappy it is to be queer in Chechnya.
Right. So, you know, it's not always so great to be queer in, you know,
Western
industrialized, you know,
nations,
countries like the U.S., like Canada, like
the EU,
UK, the EU. It tends to be better, easier, at least from a legal perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But folks are still folks,
yeah,
and they're still terrible to queer people. You know, I'm an example of someone who, you know, has thrived as a queer person, and I have family, immediate family members, who are not down
mm-hmm.
for it. So, like, that doesn't affect my life in any way. But what if everybody in your family was like that?
Yeah.
What if everyone in your community was like that? You know, it wouldn't matter. You live in a rural part of the United States where you really might be the only one. You got to get out of there.
Yeah.
You know, they talk about how, you know, oh, all the big cities are filled with the LGBT community. Yeah, because we had to escape your beautiful little small towns to get the hell out and with our lives.
Exactly.
So the...
And if you're in, you know, Georgia or Chechnya or other satellites of Russia, you know, you need to get to, you know, I don't know, Romania, Greece,
I don't know.
I don't know where the nearest places where they're flooding to, but they where they're fleeing to rather, but they need to flee because things are real bad.
So I so I'm glad this film exists.
Mm-hmm.
It is not the traumatic viewing experience that Welcome to Chechnya is.
No.
I saw that with you earlier this year. When it comes on HBO, watch it if you feel, you know, sturdy.
Yeah.
But the, you know, it does, this film does show a side of the coming out experience that is not as lighthearted as American media has presented it to us recently.
Sure.
Yeah.
But it's also not a horror show.
No, it's not a horror show. And I'm kind of, I was grateful for that.
Yeah.
As well.
For sure.
You watched two things that I did not.
Yes. One of which I think you should see and one I do not.
I will probably get around to Bad Education.
Yeah.
I just am not getting around to it today.
and it's fine. It's, you know, it's good.
Tell me everything about it.
Okay, so it's based on a true story.
Convince me. Debate me.
I'm annoyed that they stole a title from Almodovar, but, you know, what are you going to do? So this is a true story. Roslyn, Long Island had a school district where they had a high school that was ranked number 4 in the country in terms of, like, test scores and, you know, college, Ivy League college admissions, the whole thing. And the district was being run by a guy named Dr. Frank Tassone. Everybody loved him. He was a charmer. He remembered everybody's name. He would, like, walk into a room and know to ask about your bowling league or how the ice skating lessons are going. Like, just one of those people with a crazy memory for, like, all that stuff. And clearly also, like, loved teaching, like, really believed in the mission and all this stuff. He has a devoted kind of right hand in the district, played by Allison Janney. A student journalist is writing kind of a puff piece about this proposed walkway that's going to go from one end of the school to the other. Frank encourages her to, like, dig deeper and ask questions. And, like, you know, he says a good journalist can turn any assignment into a story. So she starts looking at the numbers and looking at the construction bids. And she soon uncovers that the Allison Janney character has been, like, squirreling away $250,000 or something like that.
Yeah.
So Allison Janney gets fired. But the further that this girl digs and the more they start investigating stuff, it turns out that between Allison Janney's character and Hugh Jackman's character, they embezzled like $11.2 million from the school district. Mind you, when the Allison Janney gets caught, though, like, nobody calls the police, nobody makes a big thing about it, because the success of the school is good for property values.
Right.
And, you know, it doesn't behoove anyone to make waves about this stuff, so they just try and kind of sweep it under the carpet. But it turns out, obviously, the trouble is just beginning. And then Hugh Jackman's character, the more we get to know him, the more levels of, like, crazy subterfuge and lies and, you know, private things. I'm trying to give away as little as possible because I went in knowing nothing.
Right.
But he is definitely like this movie. The best thing it does is the way that it just unravels the onion of the Hugh Jackman character of Dr. Frank Tassone. Because it's like there's another thing, and then there's another thing, and then there's another thing. It is directed by Corey Finley. Did you see Thoroughbreds?
No.
Okay.
That was a It came and went, and we missed it.
Yeah, I saw it.
You saw it.
We did it for breakfast all day. Thoroughbreds is the kind of, you know, I think what the two movies have in common is sort of like, you know, bad things in nice neighborhoods. You know, right. The sort of veneer of like wealthy families and beautiful neighborhoods and all this stuff. And then like, you know, you dig in a little and awful, awful stuff is going down. I think this movie would have benefited from having a darker sense of humor.
Right.
Like, yeah, like it needed to be a little more cutting, or at least a little more like, why am I blanking on his name? The sideways guy. Alexander Payne.
Alexander Payne.
Like a little more of an Alexander Payne kind of sense of humor about
right.
it. This is a little straightforward. And I mean, it's a crazy enough story that the straightforwardness is, you know, there's enough there certainly. But I think they could have had more fun with it. Really good cast though. Ray Romano's in it. Anna Lee Ashford. The student journalist is played by Geraldine Viswanathan from Blockers. Broadway guy whose name is Steven Spinella, Raphael Casal from Blind Spotting, Alex Wolf. Well, my letters are swimming in front of me today. So you know, it's funny, and it's, you can't believe this thing went down, and it did. Like you go read the articles afterwards, and it's like, yeah, this didn't quite happen that way, and this character isn't exactly the same thing, but for the most part, yeah, this is what happened. And literally the story was broken by the school paper.
I like a heist. I'm a big fan.
Okay.
Stealing is, it's punk to steal.
Uh-huh.
Okay. I'm not a fan of stealing money from school districts.
Right. Well, they're not the heroes for that.
But in my economy, heist people are the heroes of the film.
Mm-hmm.
But they should heist a bank.
Sure.
It should always be a bank.
Yes.
Or a casino. A casino's fine as well, because yeah. That's like, they're never going broke.
Or like the government.
Depends on which government.
True.
what branch? Yes. You know, like, I like a bank. I like a nice bank heist, because banks are evil.
Well, yeah.
And so they deserve...
They had it coming.
They deserve to be heisted. Not a big fan of heisting school districts. Having said that, get yours. And so...
So anyway, that one I think you would enjoy. You should check it out.
I'll probably get around to it, I guess.
Yeah, it's not a high priority, but interested around. The other one is All Night and a Day, which is also streaming on Netflix. It is not the directorial debut, as it turns out, of... let me get this person's name right. I don't have it in front of me. It is... he's one of the writers of Black Panther, Joe Robert Cole.
Okay.
It's his second feature.
Right.
Again, great ensemble cast.
Yeah.
You've got Ashton Sanders from Moonlight. Jeffrey Wright is in this. Regina Taylor from I'll Fly Away. It is... Yahya Abdul-Mateen II. You didn't watch HBO's Watchmen, did you?
No.
Oh, well, anyway.
But I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, he's really interesting.
Yeah.
This is a movie about a young guy who is trying to become a musician, who's trying to sort of break the cycle of crime and abuse that has existed in his family.
Uh-huh.
There's flashbacks to his father, Jeffrey Wright, sort of like forcing him to be tough by like beating it into him.
Beating
basically.
Him. I walked through the living room while that scene was going down. Yeah. I thought, no, I don't want to watch a child get beaten.
You know, the movie opens with the lead character committing a rather brutal murder.
Yes.
And then refusing to say in court why he did it.
Yeah.
And so the narrative is set up to be like, well, we're gonna go through his life.
We're gonna show you what led to this.
Exactly.
Right.
And get you to that place. And it's not that reveal isn't particularly interesting.
Right.
It doesn't work as a turning point for the screenplay. There were times where I thought this feels like the kind of movie that Don't Be a Menace is making fun of. Like it feels very that 90s post Boys in the Hood gang drama. There's a gang in this one, but it's that kind of movie,
right?
And not that there aren't stories to be told there, and that's not.
No, I remember Menace to Society being really great.
Yeah,
yeah.
And it's not obviously that there aren't still issues about like black people in the American justice system. Like there's correct. A lot. There's a plenty of material there.
Right.
It is not being told very well here.
Okay.
Apart from, like I said, the acting's really good. There are individual scenes that stand out. Like there's a moment where one character is racing somewhere on like a friend's bike. And as he's like, riding really fast through the streets of Oakland, he's suddenly surrounded by like all these little kids on bikes, just like
right.
enjoying themselves and in the street
right.
while he's like all, intense and focused. Right. And that's kind of a cool moment. There's a really, there's a part where like somebody's having a big birthday party out in like this intersection
yeah.
where they basically kind of block the streets off with cars, like with, sort of,
like a big block party.
Big block party. And, yeah. and a lot of, like, sort of, not show cars, but, like when you, like, here, when you go to the beach those days where, like, all the lowriders are there, like, mm-hmm. there's all these just amazing cars.
Yeah.
And that whole Oakland car culture thing. And the camera is, like, there's a long, kind of uninterrupted sort of 360 take of right. what's going on. And, of course, like, it's awesome and it's fun. And then, like, something terrible happens, So there are moments where you're like, oh, okay, this is a director who's really thought about this material and how he wants to present it. But overall, it just feels kind of trite,
Right.
In the same way that, like, August Wilson in the Colored Museum has that whole section at the end where he calls the last mama on the couch play.
Okay.
Whereas, like we've seen this enough times. Let's tell this story in another way.
Right.
This, to me, just felt like this is a script that got turned down after Menace to Society and Juice and whatever else came
out.
So yeah, I wanted to like it more. There are things about it that work, but overall I thought it was kind of a letdown.
That's a bummer, mostly because even all these years after a film that broke ground like mm-hmm. Boys in the Hood did, you still don't get enough black narrative. There's
sure.
still not enough black cinema that reaches, an audience.
Yes.
And you're hoping all of it's good.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Especially on something like Netflix, where it's going to have such a larger footprint
right.
than most movies in general do,
right.
whether it's theatrical or, for streaming somewhere else.
I have a streaming / DVD recommendation.
Okay, what do you got?
It's a recommendation for a limited audience, though.
Okay. So is my streaming pick, but...
It's called Blank City.
Okay.
It's a documentary from 2010. It's streaming for free right now on Vimeo.
Hmm.
And it is a documentary about the sort of... cinema of transgression / no wave music movement in New York of the early 80s throughout the 80s. So it's about
like Richard Hell kind of.
Obviously there was a film called Blank Generation that, from that Richard Hell song, but this is a film about filmmakers like Amos Poe and Eric Mitchell, Beth B., Richard Kern, Nick Zedd, Jim Jarmusch.
Do we count Susan Seidelman of that school?
She's in it.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
And so it's a good history lesson.
Mm-hmm.
It's an okay documentary,
okay.
but full of information.
Sure.
And
they've got a great subject matter, even if the execution is.
Here I am going to, I'm recommending it, but then I'm telling you what's wrong with it.
That's how we do.
I could have done with one or two or three fewer interviewees who talked about how hard and raw and true we all were back then, man. And I was, and every time that happened, Lydia Lunch over and over.
I have about had it with documentaries about New York City in the early 80s and how vibrant the art scene was because the rents were so cheap. Like, yes, we know. Stop patting yourselves on the back.
It's not as good a document as Downtown 81, which is really great.
Uh-huh. the example of those movies.
Yeah, Downtown 81 is wonderful. There's also a Sonic Youth documentary called Put Blood in the Music that just recently wound up on YouTube again this week. So this kind of all is in my head this past week.
Gotcha.
If you don't know much about this era, this is a good place to start.
Okay.
And you get to, you know, see little clips and stuff from people's
early work.
And you also get to see how handsome Richard Kern is. You're just like, oh, look at you.
Is he like all elder statesman now?
Yeah, he's like, you know, I don't know how old he is now, but he's just like, you see the old clips of him in the 80s, and you're like, oh yeah, you were, you know, young and kind of hot, I guess. But like, now he's like, you know.
Oh, professor.
Yeah, it's, you expect him to look, it's, and in fact, handsome is not the right word. He looks like the kind of person who has taken really good care of himself all this time. Instead of somebody who did lots of drugs and drank and hung out at CBGB too many times. Like,
I stopped buying heroin and started buying moisturizer.
Yeah. So that was kind of a revelation. Because, you know, this guy made Fingered.
Yeah.
Did you ever see that?
I know of it. I've never seen
it. Let me tell you. Back in the 80s, in Lubbock, Texas, the punk rock thing to do was pass around VHS tapes of Fingered.
Gotcha.
And show people who had never seen Fingered before and watch them go, hey. Okay. Because it's so many. Listen, it's a bad things happen. Mm. You don't. If you're sensitive to bad things happening in films.
Is Freddy Got Fingered like an homage?
No.
No? Okay.
Well, spiritually, I see. I guess, in a comedic way. Fingered is not a comedy.
Gotcha.
But, you know, like, they show you clips from You Killed Me First with David Vinerovich and Lung Leg, who was in the Death Valley 69 video from Sonic Youth that Richard Kern also directed. He was in... she was in Submit to Me. You know, all these are rough films that people were making back then, and they showed them wherever they could.
Okay, wait, this is one of those things. This is the touch me I'm sick, touch me I'm dick thing.
Okay.
So somebody, there's some novel or movie that has a character where somebody made a movie called Submit to My Finger.
Oh, what novel is that?
Can't remember.
Okay, now. Well then they're goofing on Richard Kern.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now I get that joke. Okay, yeah. I gotcha.
You can Google that later and tell me where that gag.
Maybe it's like Paul Rudnick's Social Disease or something.
Maybe.
I don't know. Maybe. I'll have to look that up. My streaming pick is also not for a mass audience, but I think for the discerning linoleum knife listener, who is cooler than the average bear. And that would be Jacques Rivette's Celine and Julie Go Boating, which is now streaming on the Criterion Channel.
Very exciting.
I'm super excited about, because that is a movie that has for some reason been really hard to come by on U.S. media. There was a VHS release back in the day, but it has never been released in the United States in Region 1 on... like DVD or Blu-ray. Now that it's on the Criterion Channel, I am like lighting candles that Criterion is going to put a Blu-ray out.
Right.
It would just be awesome.
Yeah.
This is a movie about two women, one of whom is a librarian, one of whom is a magician's assistant, who sort of enter each other's lives in an unusual way and go on an adventure. And it's not even like, I can't even spoil this movie, because to know what this movie is about is barely scratching the surface. I will say this. It is a movie that for the first half of it, you're going to be like, what's going on?
Yeah.
And then the second half, you will be glued to it, trying to figure out where it's all going to go and how it's going to resolve itself.
Yeah.
It is like a dream you had that you're able to remember in pieces. I know this sounds ridiculously like fatuous, but trust me, this is one of my favorite movies ever.
Didn't your students at Chapman hate you for
this? Oh, they were furious. Because I will say, I was an adjunct at Chapman. I breezed in one night a week. But from what everything I've heard about people who have been through that program or know about that program,
right.
You go to Chapman to learn how to make Hollywood movies.
Okay.
And that's fine. That is, I'm sure, for a lot of parents who are footing the bill for film
school.
So
you roll up with Celine and Julie Go Boating and like, hello, students.
Exactly. I wanted to mess with their heads a little, and they were not having it. But
I remember the first time you and I sat down to watch it. This was in the 90s.
It was a VHS. It came on two tapes.
Two VHS tapes, yeah.
It's like a three-hour movie.
And I remember when we got to the end of the first tape, I said, I don't know if I can deal with the rest of this. Like, I'm trying to get my hooks into this movie. I'm trying to get some kind of my bearings here, and I don't have them yet. Let me have a snack. I'll sit down and watch the second half, the second tape. And then we did. And my mind was blown.
Yeah.
And I learned on that day that I loved Jacques Rivette.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that was my gateway drug for him, too.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Celine and Julie Go Boating, Criterion Channel. Please
sit down on a nice afternoon when you don't have to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Turn off your
devices.
Phone. This is a no-phone movie.
Uh-huh.
You better be paying attention.
Yeah.
And
get swept up in
immerse yourself into the weirdness of it. Yeah. Didn't we see it again at CineFamily?
After
we moved here,
we
went to that, and it was still...
It was great to see it projected.
Intoxicating. Yeah. I really love this film.
You and I, we're going to sit down sometime this month and watch it.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
I'll watch it again.
Yeah.
I'll watch it again and again.
Absolutely.
I don't care.
We have some letters.
Okay. Glenn says, I thoroughly enjoyed your encore presentation of Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife. Clue.
Yes. Incidentally, if you are a member of our Patreon at patreon.com/linoleumknife,
if you join at the $1 month level.
At any level, but even at the dollar level, you get Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife, which is a series of episodes where we devote the entire episode to one movie. And the old ones that I've been reposting are back when we did like literal DVD commentaries that lasted as long as the movie did.
Yes.
Now we're doing new versions of them where they're like 20, 30 minutes and, you know, we're in and out and get it.
They've gone as long as an hour.
Yes. The ideas are 20 or 30 minutes.
If we just can't shut up.
Exactly. But Clue was one of the old school ones where our commentary is as long as the movie is. And so I just reposted it and people have been enjoying it.
Yeah, because originally Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife was for Patreon subscribers who were at a higher dollar a month.
Originally, it was a thing we sold a la carte before we even had a Patreon.
Right, right. But you need to go all back that way for that kind of explanation. But like, it was A, the length of the film, and B, for more money per month than what. And when we decided to rearrange our stuff, we decided LK Presents More LK should be at the dollar level. The episodes should be shorter and much more frequent.
Yes.
Because they were taking so much work and effort and research and script writing. Like, it was basically, you must remember this. And so, that's a lot of, listen.
So rather than doing
applause to the people who can do that kind of thing.
Yeah,
but
we were doing three or four a year, but now
we're getting bogged down.
Doing them almost every week. So,
Yeah, 2 to 4 times a month. Minimum 2 times a month, sometimes every week.
So we
didn't do one last week, but we've got one coming this week.
We will, yeah.
And so,
we just reposted
a buck.
I just reposted Clue, and
Glenn says,
comments.
My observation. You discussed how Gore Verbinski was all set to do a remake of the film, and that if it were to be remade, it could be a serious locked room murder mystery. Funny how years later we had Knives Out. You guys are the most prophetic of married film critics / food podcasters.
Well, given that that's probably a really small sampling group, I'll take it.
Yeah. And he has a question. If Clue, an initial flop, became a cult hit after being adopted by a younger generation, decades later, what flop film in the past couple of years will Generation ZZZ, or whatever they will be called, adopt as their own? Gem and the Holograms? Cats? The Kitchen? Discuss.
I think the tricky thing is that the reason that millennials fell in love with Clue was that it was on HBO all the time when they were very young and there weren't a ton of options.
Right.
And, you know, I think through repetition, through coming in the middle and being like, what is this? And watching it again from the beginning, like that enabled people to sort of discover this movie that had been kind of written off by older moviegoers and by the original, you know, box office audience. But nowadays, given the diffusion of entertainment possibilities and streaming channels and Netflix and Hulu and whatever, I don't know that there's enough people watching the same stuff at the same time to then create a cult for films in that way. I'm sure there will still be cult films and they'll still happen for whatever reason, but the specifics of Clue, I think, was about people who were 8 years old watching it on HBO, and then decades later, you know, becoming Adam Berry and writing for BuzzFeed.
The closest thing I can see to a Clue-style reappraisal slash cult following happening is Josie and the Pussycats.
That's true. Yes. And I think Cats is very quickly becoming that, but more in a sense of like...
Cats is a goofy group experience.
This is terrible in a fascinating way.
Terrible in a fascinating way, exactly. Josie and the Pussycats was always good.
Yes. Just misunderstood.
Yeah. Note my positive review of its initial release. Just FYI. Okay. JD asks, so you're telling me that you don't go to Gwen Stefani's house to make pasta on Sunday morning? That is correct. Now, if Gwen Stefani invited me to her home to make pasta on Sunday morning, I would say, Gwen, do you have appropriate protective gear for me to wear?
What's your PPE situation?
I understand that your kitchen is most likely enormous.
And spotless.
So I wouldn't feel, you know, in danger being in your kitchen. And I could probably stay well more than 6 feet away from you. So, yeah, I would go. Like, she would have to give me some tea that I actually wanted, though.
Well.
Not just the chamomile. I'm not, you know. I bet she can sip on the chamomile all day.
She strikes me as a kombucha lady.
You said that before.
Did I?
Okay. You said, I bet she makes her own kombucha.
Stand by it.
I bet her personal chef makes her the kombucha.
Well, that too. Yeah. Yeah.
Kat says, Simon Callow is a British institution.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't seen Golden Years from 2016, you really should. It's hilarious, and his character is great. He also played Charles Dickens a bunch of times.
Huh. Yeah. Okay, I can see that.
I haven't seen Golden Years.
I have not.
Yeah.
Is it a series or a movie? Do we know?
Don't know.
We'll look it up.
Oh, hey, I just got an email from our accountant.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. It's nothing. Listen, don't get excited. It's nothing special. We just had to file our business taxes.
Yes.
For 2019. What year is it?
For 2019.
We just had to file our business taxes for 2019.
Yes.
And he's getting back to me on that.
Hooray.
So, we're done.
No, there's
not one more letter.
That was it?
That's it.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Great. Well, I guess we are done then. Yeah. All right. Listen, thanks everybody for listening. Thank you, Blue, as always, for our theme music. Check him out at blutopia.com. That's also the name of his YouTube channel, BLEUTOPIA. He's always got some fun stuff going on. Check out all of our friends on the internet. Go over to the critically acclaimed network, see what Bibbs and Whitney are up to. The Schmoes Know, Dennis Enyun with Dennis Hensley, The Comics Canon, All Things Cozy, Deck the Hallmark, Big Fat Gay Podcast, Sewers of Paris, Fat Guys of the Movies, Criterion Cast, and Secretly Timid. Go check out my other shows. I'm on Breakfast All Day on the Maximum... No, sorry. I'm on Breakfast All Day, full stop. And I'm also on Who Shot Ya on the Maximum Fun Network. And we're doing a thing, if you like the LK Club meeting, on Saturday the 16th of May at 1 o'clock Pacific time, we're going to do a Who Shot Ya Twitch on Ify Nwadwe's Twitch channel where we all watch The Avengers. So join us for that. You can subscribe to this show for free on Apple Podcasts and leave us a positive review. We'll read all the 5-star reviews here on the show. You can also leave us positive feedback in the many places that we stream, including Stitcher Radio, Spotify, Google Play, CastBox, Podbean, TheLounge.com. We are at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. We have a Patreon at patreon.com/linoleumknife. That's where LKTV lives, a podcast of the television, Linoleum Knife and Fork, a podcast of the food, Linoleum Nights, the club meeting, t-shirts, Christmas ornaments, all kinds of stuff. patreon.com/linoleumknife. And you can drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. We love to hear from you. These are difficult times, especially now, but we thank you for taking time out to listen to us and to hang out. It's always lovely to spend time with you. Take care of yourselves and each other. We'll see you next time, and until then,
goodbye.